actually saw Lando, but really needs no introduction. Any of us who listen to KPFK radio have heard his commentary. And in addition, Saul is a professor at Cal Poly Pomona, and he's also a distinguished documentary filmmaker. And tonight he's going to speak on the topic Between Iraq and a Hard Place.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be at the Duck Club. I sometimes get the feeling in recent times that I'm back in the days of Charles Dickens. You all remember how the Tale of Two Cities began. It was the worst of times, and it was the worst of times. I'm going to start by just reading you from poll data. This is from a Miami Herald story on the 14th of June, so it's not that long ago. The headline, many believe Iraq had and used weapons. Polls say beliefs, facts conflict. And Dateline, Washington, D.C. The first line, a third of the American public believes U.S. forces found weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, according to a recent poll. 22% said Iraq actually used chemical or biological weapons. Just before the war, half of those polled in the survey said that Iraqis were among the 19 hijackers on September 11, 2001. Now, I found that probably the most shocking and saddest news that I'd read in a long time. And I'm including, in a sense, all the horrors that are coming out of Israel and Palestine. Every time there's a bus bombing or assassination by helicopter rockets, those are terrible events. But in a sense, here we are in our own country, and I ask myself, do I have any idea who lives in this country with me? I remember after the 2000 election, a lot of people said it was Ralph Nader who cost Al Gore the presidency. And I said, I didn't think so. That if there was one factor that had caused Al Gore the presidency, you have to go lower and in a more horrible direction to find it. And that factor was Joe Lieberman. That is, you have to look at the anti-Semitism that still remains in this country. Anybody who thinks it's all gone here? Joe Lieberman, why didn't Al Gore win his own state, Tennessee? Why didn't he win Arkansas, where Bill Clinton was from? And why did he suffer such a devastating loss in traditionally Democratic areas in the north of Florida? I don't know, I have no scientific evidence, but I assumed, as a Jew, that it was Joe Lieberman. This is the country we live in. It's a country in which the people are misinformed, but who misinforms them? This is the question we have to ask. When a president prepares a country for war, as President Bush did, and he claimed we were going to war, you have to have a good reason to go to war.
He doesn't.
You have to. Or else it is a crime. Does anybody not believe that? It is a crime to wage aggressive war. Aggressive war means a war in which you are not immediately threatened. And if anybody doubts me, let me quote you from Supreme Court Justice Robert L. Jackson. We must make clear to the Germans that the wrong for which their fallen leaders are on trial is not that they lost the war, but that they started it. And we must not allow ourselves to be drawn into a trial of the causes of the war. For our position is that no grievances or policies will justify resort to aggressive war. It is utterly renounced and condemned as an instrument of policy. Robert L. Jackson, Supreme Court Justice, and United States representative to the International Conference on Military Trials in Nuremberg, Germany, August 12, 1945. The importance of Nuremberg, of placing the German leaders, and later in Japan, of placing their leaders on trial, was to establish that one basic fact. You can't make war anymore unless you have what is in political science called a casus belli, a justifiable reason. That is, as President Bush said, Iraq is an imminent threat to U.S. security. As Tony Blair said, we cannot allow this man to use these weapons of mass destruction. He could use them at any moment. And that's why we have to go to war. Those were the reasons that were given. I don't have to go back and quote you the hundreds of citations of President Bush, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Secretary of State Powell, and so on, all of whom cited as the cause for going to war, the possession by Saddam Hussein of nuclear weapons or his attempt to get them, his possession of chemical and biological weapons, and his imminent threat to use them. It turns out now that the document that President Bush cited in his State of the Union address, in which he said that the United States government had proof that Iraq had attempted to make a purchase toward nuclear weapons, and that purchase was done in Africa, this document turned out to be not only fraudulent and forged, but the report had come in to Vice President Cheney's office weeks before the State of the Union address, saying that it was a patent and obvious forgery. The CIA had the same information, as did the Secretary of State. Yet the president used that information to convince Congress and the American public that he had a cause to go to war. I don't want to get into the idea that Saddam Hussein was a good guy. He was a monster. I hated him. He killed friends of mine. I don't want to say anything to justify his government. I don't think he has many friends throughout the world. But that is not a cause of war. And it's very important to understand that, or else we throw out all of the law that we have developed over the last almost 60 years. That means the United Nations, which was founded on the premise that we can avoid war by setting up international standards, is almost obsolete as a result of the United States decision anyway. All right, I want to start with that premise, that a major crime was committed. Not that Saddam was a good guy, but that a crime was committed. And that if you set this precedent and lie, maybe he didn't lie, maybe he was simply misinformed, but misinformed by whom? The CIA? If the CIA can't collect intelligence in the manner it is, maybe we should do something about reforming it, make it into a branch of the Library of Congress, for example, where we have access to it, where we can see the people who are collecting the intelligence and ask them questions. Like, any of you guys find any solid evidence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and was prepared to use them?
Scuds?
Have you found any?
Well, they were there.
No, they're who not. Was there?
I know somebody who was in Israel when the Scuds were hitting Israel.
What does that got to do?
That was in 1991.
That was 1991. That was 12 years ago. And the United Nations weapons inspectors spent 8 years in Iraq finding and destroying weapons. 8 years.
There's also a possibility that they hid
Yeah, or they put the germs into the soccer balls and kicked them over the Syria, right?
There's another, the UN. There's another question that you didn't address.
Yeah.
The United Nations had an agreement ending the first conflict for inspection.
Mm-hmm.
Saddam violated that agreement and kicked out the inspectors.
Really? When?
Right, yes.
When did he kick them out, please? When? Excuse me, when did he kick them out?
I thought that he kicked them out just before...
In 1998. That is what all of the news sources reported last year. Fact. Saddam Hussein never kicked out the UN weapons inspectors. They were ordered to leave by the Secretary General of the United Nations. He never kicked them out, albeit every single news source from New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post, ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, of course, all reported in 2002 that he had kicked them out in 1998. The very same sources all reported in 1998 that the weapons inspectors were ordered to leave by the United Nations because President Clinton was preparing to bomb Iraq. The reason that he refused to let the weapons inspectors back in was because it turned out that some of them were spying for the United States and Great Britain, and instead of looking for weapons of mass destruction, were reporting the coordinates of targets to the U.S. and British air forces. Facts. Anybody want to argue with these facts? You can go to any newspaper in 1998 and you will get that story. In 2002, you could go to any newspaper and not get that story.
Excuse me, interrupt briefly. There was an article in the New York Times just 2 days ago that the CIA thoroughly disclaimed what President Bush has used them to say that they have found all this evidence. So it was in the newspaper.
Yes.
The CIA said...
Yes, but CIA Director George Tenet went before the Senate and said, well, we did find them. Previously, CIA Director George Tenet had gone before the Senate and said, well, we haven't found them.
So now
so somebody's lying. All right? Somebody's lying. Now, there's two things here that distress me. One is a major illegal act has occurred, and nothing is being done about it. Two, that is, a war has been started without cause. That if there was no imminent threat to the United States, its security, the region's security, etc. Bush and Blair claimed that that was the reason for going to war. Not because Saddam Hussein was a thug, a monster, or whatever. Okay? Those were not causes for going to war. It sets a really dangerous precedent. The second is, the American public now believes, a good percentage of them, that in fact there were weapons. When newspapers and much of the television is now reporting that none have been found. The UN weapons inspectors, when they went back in 2002, did not find any. President Bush said, I'm a patient man. I'll wait a little longer. Secretary of State Colin Powell sat on television before the UN Security Council, and he said, they are in this place, and this place, and this place, and he pointed out on the map where they were. The UN inspectors went there and didn't find them. Having not found them, of course, then the United States military inspection team went to those same places, and thousands of others, and have failed at this point to come up with a single anthrax spore. I'm not saying they're not there, I don't know. But so far, all of the detectives of the world have not found it. And these are the best there are. You don't find anybody better than the UN weapons inspectors or the US military inspectors. There aren't any better inspectors. All right, we're in a serious situation. We have a public that is seriously deluded and ignorant. A public that still harbors all kinds of, how should I put it, ethnic and racial and religious prejudices. We have a very strange coalition running the foreign and defense policy of the United States. I would call them a coalition of anti-Semitic, right-wing fundamentalist Christians and neoconservative Jews. This is, of course, a sexless marriage. However, the rest of us are getting well screwed. It is a very strange predicament in the world. when you have the Jewish homeland, Israel, being supported by some of the worst anti-Semites in the United States. I'll give you an example. My wife's grandmother, whom we visited in a place you've all heard of, Rising Star, Texas. It's right near Blanket, for those of you who don't know. When we visited my wife, who is a Texan, we visited her grandma. Grandma was sitting in a rocking chair and watching a televangelist, a fellow named James Roberson. And literally, like a minute after we arrived, I hear Roberson saying, "And God does not hear the prayer of Jews." And I said, "Oops." And you don't want to do business with those people either, he says.
We could give away checks.
So I said, "Well, you and your grandma have lots to talk about. I think I'll just go check out the town." When we returned that night to Dallas, the rabbi of Fort Worth, Texas, on the news, claimed that Roberson was an anti-Semite, based on what he'd said. The next morning, Roberson called a press conference to declare he was not an anti-Semite, and he removed from his neck a chain with a Star of David on it. And he said, "Look, Menachem Begin gave me this because of my loyalty to Israel." And he said, "Menachem Begin and I agree on our fundamental principle." And the reporter says, "Well, what principle is that?" He says, "All Jews should be in Israel." I couldn't believe what I was hearing. A reporter says, "If you're not an anti-Semite, what's an anti-Semite?" Roberson says, "An anti-Semite, well, that's somebody who hates Jews more than he's supposed to." I don't think that this is the prevailing sentiment in the United States. I think it's a distinct minority sentiment. But it is not an indistinct sentiment when it comes to the Israeli support that is being generated from fundamentalist Christian circles, most of whom agree that God in one way or another has shut his ears to the prayer of Jews. But they're all for Israel, and not because they care about Jews. Because of the biblical gibberish about Gog, Magog, and Armageddon, in which all of these battles have to take place before the kingdom of the millennium ensues and the rapture unfolds. This is a very peculiar position. But you have some of the toughest soldiers of the Republican Party adhering to this position. You have some of the key supporters of President Bush adhering to this position. And they've made a strange political alliance with Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Fife and other people who are in the neocon wing of the defense establishment. These, to my mind, are troubling alliances. And we have to take them as signs of our time.
But excuse me, if I'm an Israeli, I'm not. And I find...
Oh, maybe it'll be company, clearly.
And I see these right-wing fundamentalist Christians supporting me. Because, I don't care what they believe. As long as I get the money from the United States, I'm going to get their support.
If you're extremely myopic, that's exactly how you would look at the world. If you have long-term interest in the survival of Israel and in the ethics of Judaism, you would look askance at such an alliance.
But there's no ethics in life.
Well...
he's not Israeli, too.
Can we hold the discussion
till later? In the old days, Jews had a wonderful sense of humor. Almost all of them. And that's how Jews have survived for so many thousands of years, being persecuted. A sense of humor is basic to survival. Right? I mean, Jews also believe in the Messiah, not just the rapturists. There was a story, in the old country where a fellow was hired, finally, and his job is to greet the Messiah when the Messiah comes. He's supposed to stand outside of the gates of the town and greet the Messiah, and he tells his wife, "I finally got a job." He says, she says, "Well, what are you making?" He says, 4 shekels a month. She said, "You're crazy? You're working for that?" He says, "Don't worry, it's a lifetime job." You know, I remember when I was a kid and the State of Israel was founded, and there were rabbis in New York who were saying that this is the sign that the Messiah will return and that all Jews should go to Israel now when the Messiah returns. And my father coming home and telling my mother this, and she's saying, "What, are you crazy? We just redid the house." I'm not seeing a lot of humor these days. I mean, certainly not in the settlements. I mean, in all of Israel today, it's hard to make a joke. Things are very grim. They're very serious. And they're very serious in the world. And I think, in a sense, we have to tell jokes. I mean, I try to think back on, ones that remind me what, like the United States now having liberated Iraq, albeit the American soldiers are being shot at, they're being stoned, and the Iraqis are in, relatively bad shape. And again, I'm reminded of the story of the Jew and the Texan on the cruise ship. And the Texan drinks himself to sleep, and the Jewish guy is enjoying, and all of a sudden the sea gets rocky, and the Jew lets go all over the Texan. And the Texan slowly wakes up, and to his horror, he's covered in vomit. And the Jewish guy leans over and says, "You feel better now?" Well, in a sense, this is what we're saying to Iraq, no? What was the war about? What is the middle? You know, and all of a sudden, George Bush, who couldn't have cared less in the year 2000 about what was going on in the Middle East, all he did was lecture Arafat, the poor loser. All of a sudden, George Bush is now going to be the peacemaker. Now we now have the final roadmap. What an unfortunate metaphor. But if there is no peace in the Middle East, there will be no peace in the world. Well, to get Tony Blair support, to get some support for his war effort, Bush had to sign on for a serious U.S. initiative. And on the day the initiative was really starting, Israeli Prime Minister Sharon sends an assassination squad to kill a Hamas top leader. I don't know how many top leaders Hamas has, but it has more top leaders than any organization I can imagine, given the amount of assassinations that the Israelis have done on their top leaders, and they still have more. Or else they're breeding like rabbits. I can't imagine how you could have so many top leaders. Why don't they ever assassinate a middle leader or a bottom leader? Anyway, that puts a crimp in the peace process. Following, you have the predictable retaliation, where some Palestinian kid blows himself up and kills 18 others on a bus.
Sal, you have the order wrong. The first event that occurred was three Palestinian organizations staged a raid in which they killed five Israeli soldiers posing for medical help.
Okay, sorry.
But before that, there was another killing by...
It's hard to... Okay, I back up. I don't know who started what when. All I know is that there is no meeting of the mind, that fanatics on both sides are determined not to make peace.
What country would allow... Would we allow Mexicans to come over here...
Speaker finish and then...
Let them go over here to what?
We conquered this portion of Mexico.
I
don't know if it belongs to Mexico. It used to belong to Mexico.
Yes. Okay. Israel was the last settler colony of the world, all right? In the middle of the 20th century, Israel became a settler colony on the premise that there would be somehow an arrangement that would lead to the harmony between these two different people. No such arrangement was ever established. And these two people eventually are going to have to live together in the same small piece of land.
You're right. And the thing is, these people have to accept the idea that people have to live and not go around killing people.
Well, on both sides. That has to be accepted.
Yeah.
Palestinians have been deep. Look, there's no way I'm going to justify suicide bombing. No way. It's not justifiable. Period. Any adult who programs a teenage kid to go blow him or herself up, there's something wrong with that person. Deeply wrong. But similarly, how do you go about picking out a target and then assassinating that target without any law, without any court, without any trial? The kids get killed alongside of it and say, too bad, we didn't mean those kids to die. On both sides, you're having a kind of violence that has no end. It can't end other than in more violence. On either side, each side has, they did that to me, they did that to us. They did. That's not the way you go about conflict resolution. It can't work. I mean, the Palestinians are a great people. A great people that seem to be cursed by terrible leaders. The Jews are a great people who seem to be cursed in Israel by terrible leaders. When they do have a leader that finally gets the courage to break through, he is assassinated, not by Palestinians. Remember, Rabin was not assassinated by Palestinians.
He was half Palestinian.
He was what?
He was half Palestinian.
Rabin?
No,
we're talking about
the assassin wasn't even 100th Palestinian. He was an ultra-Orthodox, extreme right-wing Jew.
No, he wasn't.
Yes, he was. Listen, man.
So we're in a state here where we have a government in the United States that has launched a war without law, that has imposed, because of 9/11, civil measures on the public in the United States that we have never seen in peacetime. Under an Ayatollah who is serving as Attorney General. I'm talking about John Ashcroft. A man who is afraid to have a bare breast on a statue in the Justice Department. And has to cover it with a burqa.
$5,000 for each one?
John Ashcroft, a politician so feeble that he couldn't win an election against a dead man in Missouri.
That's true.
Has become the most powerful attorney general in U.S. history. Under the Patriot Act and a whole variety of other emergency measures, any of you who've been to the doctor recently will know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes.
You have lost your right to privacy. It does no longer exist. You sign away, if you want to get treated now, you sign away all the rights you thought you had to privacy. Under the name of, and these people are libertarians, by the way, these people used to be until they tasted power. The logic of Ashcroft, I can only imagine, if there is a logic to it, as stemming from President Bush's explanation of 9/11. And his explanation of 9/11 was as complicated as most of the explanations he gives about things. He said, basically, they hate us because we're free. Right. Period. Ashcroft then logically proceeds to strip away our freedoms. Don't you get it? So they'll hate us less.
This is the president elected.
But the worst of this is that we're supposed to be a country of two parties. But where were the Democrats? The Democrats couldn't sign on fast enough. Nobody could wait for an explanation. To this day, we've had no explanation of 9/11. Anybody want to try to explain 9/11? Why mostly Saudis, not connected in any way, shape, or form with Saddam Hussein, enemies of Saddam Hussein, thinking Saddam Hussein was a heretic, a secular sellout, did these absolutely fiendish deeds? Why? Because they were crazy? Because they were fanatics? What were their political goals? Anybody know? Anybody ask?
They don't want the Americans in that land.
Thank you. Political goal number one, get the U.S. troops out of the holy shrine. Out. April 29, 2003, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld announces the United States troops will be withdrawn from the Saudi bases. Who won? Goal number one, political goal number one, get the U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia. If anybody cuts through the mist on the windshield left by all the rhetoric that's spewed out there, you can find out with great difficulty what these people actually wanted. And they got it, number one. Number two, reform, clean up the corrupt royal family of Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that's important.
All right? How do you go about that? Well, first of all, you stop the infidels from training their National Guard. Witness the bombing at Riyadh last month. What was the purpose of that bombing? And who was it directed against? The Vanel Corporation, whose trainers are there to train the Saudi National Guard. You don't read it in the newspaper? Gee, funny.
Yes, we do.
A third and much lesser goal was to rid the Arab world of secular sellout leaders like Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. So who is achieving the goals in this war against terrorism? The terrorists or us? Way, way, way down peripherally, there's a sop thrown in for the Palestinian cause. Very peripheral. Israel, Palestine is not on their main agenda. Understand that. The terrorism that's going on, and I put that in quote because terrorism is being practiced on both sides. When a helicopter gunship fires a missile at a house or a car, that's state measures, and when it's done by non-state, it's called terrorism. Come on, it's both terrorism. It terrorizes people. That's the point of it. The Israel-Palestine conflict had little to do with 9/11. None of the people involved were Palestinians. These were these Wahhabi cultists from Saudi Arabia. If any of you read the New York Times, I don't know, magazine maybe two and a half months ago, you would have seen an article by Paul Berman analyzing the theology of Mr. Khattab, the theologian, the inspiration of the Wahhabis, of the so-called Al-Qaeda. I don't know whether Al-Qaeda exists or not. I mean, we know they're certainly terrorist organizations. And if you read that, you read that this man was an incredibly intelligent, a deeply sensitive man, and he was assassinated by Mubarak in Egypt, in a prison cell. Or was it Sadat? I think it was Sadat who assassinated him. Excuse me.
Yeah. Nasser.
Was it Nasser?
Nasser.
He was a dangerous man to all people who wanted secular rule in the Arab world. But his analysis of the modern world was quite interesting. He said human nature and contemporary life are totally out of sync. That human nature is indeed incompatible with the kind of life we now lead. And there can be no harmony, there can be no spirituality, unless a fundamental change exists in the world. And of course, at that point, I broke all agreement with him when he goes on to, when he gets into his methods of how you're going to change this, which is essentially by sacrificial acts. But this is the man who is the inspiration for these terrorists who did the 9/11 deeds. How many of you knew that? Very few.
What's his name? I miss his name.
Khattab. Q-U-T-B.
Sayyid Khattab.
Yeah. Now, isn't that something that the American public... Now, you're not among those people here, who most of you, who believe that there were, in fact, weapons of mass destruction found in Iraq. But, at the same time, you share with most of the American public a generalized ignorance about the facts of 9/11, certainly the most singularly important event in our history in many, many years. I would say it's a watershed in our history, in world history. How do you explain that ignorance? Not because you're not educated people. You are all educated people. You all probably read the same newspaper and watch fairly similar television shows and even listen, some of you, to Pacifica Radio, on which you would not have heard this analysis. Now, this is serious. I mean, first of all, it's the government's job to explain things like this to the public. Secondly, it's the media's job to inform the public and to give analysis that is relevant. So you have failures on two basic fronts here. I mean, I have to go to great lengths in order to scrape this information out. I've got to go to foreign sources. Some of them not English sources. English language, that is. So there's a serious lack of information and analysis about the most important events of our times. It doesn't mean our values have shifted, but it means that we are not citizens of a republic. And that's an important fact. We are now members of an empire. A republic is a system of accountability. That's the whole nature of its governance. If anybody remembers when they were in college, everybody read the Federalist Papers, and you all read the explanations of why a republic is superior to a confederation. When James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and John Jay made these arguments, they were all saying that the fundamental nature of a republic is not to worry, you will have full accountability. We have no accountability. None. We have millions of documents classified every month. On what basis? Why can't we know?
Therefore, we're not members, we're subjects.
Okay. But we're subjects and beneficiaries. We're all living well. I don't mean everybody in this country is living well, but 60% or 70% of this country is living at a fairly comfortable level. And we have become immensely self-absorbed as a people. And understandably, recent study said that most Americans absorb between 3,000 and 3,600 messages a day. Messages that they have not asked to receive. I don't mean just the billboards on the freeway, where you're told that you're driving the wrong car, you have your mortgage rate's too high, you're listening to the wrong radio station, and you haven't yet had the great experience of visiting the Spearmint Rhino Club. And I don't mean just the constant screaming of ads on the radio, or on television, or in the newspaper, where you read bomb kills 18 in Israel, 68 wounded, and then you have a half-naked woman underneath it saying, buy this bra. What's the real message of that page? Which one is it? What? You've got to have an enormous filtration system in your brain every single day to wade through this barrage, this machine-gunning of messages that hit you. And every one of the messages, in one way or another, is telling you, you, the center of the universe, first message, are too deeply inadequate. That's the nature of the message, right? It's not just you're living in the wrong house, you got the wrong mortgage rate, you're driving the wrong car, you're not getting a decent love life, you're not getting the status, prestige, honorific deferences, you're not getting the pleasure you ought to have out of life. The reason is you don't have... you haven't put this under your arm, you haven't squirted that on your head, you're not drinking the right beer, whatever it is, all right? There is something deeply wrong with you. Now, 3,600 hits a day, okay? Imagine what the human brain has to create in order to filter out these unwanted messages. Now, how do you get to be a citizen when the message that you're getting is about your own inadequacy and not about the nature of the world and therefore the politics that you can use to participate in the drama and the history of your time as a citizen? That's, we only get one shot at it. I'm sorry if there's anybody who believes in reincarnation, but for those of you who don't, we have one shot at it to participate in the history of our time, in the action of our time. And the whole point of living in a republic, in a democratic system, was to allow us to participate. But in fact, when the information is taken, when the conditioning of the citizenry vitiates the very chance of participation, it becomes incredibly difficult to do so. So it is, in a sense, not that shocking that a huge percentage of the American public believes that, in fact, we did discover weapons of mass destruction. When, in fact, headline after headline in newspaper, television show, radio show has said the exact opposite. Saddam Hussein informed the United States ambassador of his intention to invade Kuwait. She, her name was April Glassy, said that she did not see any conflict with U.S. interests. But to be fair to Mrs. Glassy, to be fair to her, I think one has to really assume that what she understood was that Saddam Hussein was going to take the tiny northeast piece of Kuwait that had historically belonged to Iraq, and which most of the world agreed belonged to Iraq. She did not think, and nobody thought at that time, that he would try to take the whole country.
What about the Shiites?
Wait a minute. Don't. What about the Shiites?
Yeah.
What about the Shiites? How do you rule a country? Now throw it to a different way. You can't throw. If you call Saddam Hussein Hitler, you're cheapening the memory, okay?
Cheapening the memory.
He tried in Iran, he failed miserably. He tried in Kuwait, he failed miserably, and the Iraqi people paid the price.
No, we were helping Iraq to fight Iran.
We helped Iraq to fight Iran in that war. And we gave him a green light, not understanding, I think, his intentions in the Kuwait war. This is established fact. I'm not making this up.
Could I ask
something? There's one very important point here. The first user of poison gas in the region was a man named Winston Churchill. Yes. He used poison gas to subdue the rebellious Iraqis so that the British could control. The British then decided that Iraq should be this country that was previously three different regions. Shiites, to answer your question, Sunnis, and a variety of other people, including some Christians. All right? The British then made a country out of three regions and put in their king, a puppet, to rule to protect their oil. Finally, Iraqis in the Ba'ath Party won independence. Now you had a country designed, shaped, formed by a colonial power. Do you break that country back into three regions, or do you rule Shiites, Sunnis, Christians together? And if so, how do you rule them? In Yugoslavia, we had another example of how you put together people that don't belong together necessarily under Tito. It is not an easy situation to inherit a colonial pattern and then all of a sudden establish a perfect democracy. Now, this is no defense of Saddam Hussein. He killed my friends. I'll never forgive him for that. But he wasn't Hitler. He was a bad guy. He set an example of failure. He tried twice. He didn't use terror except against his own people. He didn't use terror abroad. He didn't drop two nuclear weapons on civilian populations, for God's sakes. Be realistic. I'm sorry.
I'd like to ask this. Why are we focusing on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? What about all the other countries Middle East and everywhere else that have weapons of mass destruction?
It's a good question, because it should have been asked when George Bush raised this in 2002, in July, a year ago, and said Iraq has weapons of mass destruction and therefore poses an imminent threat to U.S. security. The answer from the Democrats should have been, go sleep it off. You've been smoking something you shouldn't have been smoking. The answer from the United Nations Security Council, don't bother us with this silliness. And the answer from the U.S. media should have been, what are you talking about? Have you gone completely crazy? But instead, everyone bought that premise, even those who knew better. And the CIA and other agencies began to manufacture evidence to support that nonsense. So that the president's pipe dream, if you like, all of a sudden became an axiom. And the entire world was caught up in debating it. Should we disarm Iraq multilaterally or unilaterally? Should we use the UN weapons inspectors, who of course found nothing, or should we use our own people? It was a debate that shouldn't have taken place. There's only one country that has serious weapons of mass destruction. Only one. Now, that requires us to be extremely prudent. When the President of the United States threatens other people and labels them as evil, right? Here's the President, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, labeling these others evil, okay? The vampires, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, the axis of evil. And he then goes on to say he will not hesitate to use preemptive nuclear strikes against them. Assuming these people are in fact evil, all right, but not illogical, what would you do if you were them? You have only one possible deterrent if you're put into that corner, and that is to develop nuclear weapons. That is the logic of President Bush's approach. What other possibility do you have for survival? Try to analyze it. Put yourselves in the shoes of these people, even though you're good and they're evil, all right? If a power like the United States says it will use preemptive nuclear strikes to take you out, how can you stop them? Other than by having a nuclear weapon, making the cost too high. This is the logic of George Bush. It's the logic of the neocons and the Armageddonites, I don't know how else you call them, on the extreme Christian right. No. You follow? All right?
Yes.
Let me conclude. And then we can have more discussion. I'll wrap up and then we can have a discussion. The people who are running the country call themselves conservatives. I frankly don't see anything conservative about them. Nothing. I consider these people to be ultra-radicals. I will quote to you a very conservative statement that I today would sign on to. Some of you might remember it. Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. How many of you remember that one? Who said it?
Barry Goldwater.
Barry Goldwater, 1964. Hear, hear. That is what we are going to be driven to if we are going to protect our rights as citizens, if we are going to make our last stand to live in a republic rather than be driven into being complete subjects of a world empire. That is my conclusion to you, because otherwise, watch out. We now have 68 bases around the world. I see, except in Saudi Arabia, no intention of leaving any of them. We are now on a permanent mission of militarization in a variety of places and for a variety of reasons. If you are in an imperial mode with 68 bases and a huge military, I don't see any way in which you can get accountability. Everything becomes a vital secret. So you have millions and millions of documents classified every month that have nothing to do with anyone. Every bureaucrat knows well how to cover his ass. You classify everything you do and nobody can touch you. That's the antithesis of accountability. And that's where we are. Somebody said in the very beginning, this is the greatest country in the world. I totally agree. Do I want to be anywhere else? Absolutely not. My place is right here, and I want to get back to the business of turning this into a more just republic again. I don't want to live in an empire. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Your question and yours are the same question. How do you get heard, and what do you do, and how do you do it? I don't have... The people in this room have as much or more experience than I. I've been a political activist most of my life. I write, I make films, I do radio, I teach, I agitate, I organize as much as I can. That's how I do it. I get together and I do. I write letters to my congressman, I send them emails now.
Doesn't work.
Excuse me. If you say it doesn't help, what are we going to do instead?
No, emails don't work. Writing does.
Well, emails, writing, telephone, fax, whatever, okay? That's one method. Another method is organizing and demonstrating. A third method is telephone everybody that you know. But most important, we have only one shot as a country every 4 years. That's it. That's the only collective participation we have. And we know that the majority of eligible Americans, or close to a majority, doesn't take advantage of that opportunity to vote once every 4 years for a common leader. All right? That's it. At this point, you have, I think, stated what is obvious to most people who are distressed right now, that if this current government continues, there is going to be a spate of ultra-right-wing, I'm not going to use the word conservative, because there's nothing conservative about them. These people are extremely radical and reactionary. All right?
John Taliban Ashcraft.
If you want to understand what this is all about, you've got to look at the most and only issue in domestic politics. I don't mean abortion. And I don't mean prayer in school. And I don't mean whether you have a right to have a howitzer in your backyard. There's one issue, and that's the budget. Who gets what and who puts what in? That's it. That's what politics ought to be about. These others are peripheral issues, distractions. And if you look at that, you will understand the goal of this administration. It is to make American workers more productive by forcing them to work much harder to make the same amount that they are today making. That is it. It's as if, it's as if the International Monetary Fund has used its formula on the United States. That is, you create increasing hardship among the poorest parts of the population, so that they must work ever harder, that has become more productive. You mentioned Karl Marx. The answer is you reduce the socially necessary cost of labor. That's what this is all about. That's what these tax policies are. They are policies designed to destroy the U.S. government. Destroy it in the sense that it offers services. Services. School services, road services, medical, whatever services the United States government offers will be destroyed, because there will be simply no money in the Treasury to do any of these functions. The only function that the U.S. government will be sufficient with will be military and police. Period. That's it. That's the political agenda of this administration. All right? Be very clear. That's what the tax policy is about. You return to the least needy public, right, the upper 1% of the population, huge amounts of dividends. To the most needy population, you take from them. You reduce their federal taxes minimally or not at all, and you increase their local and state taxes by a considerable extent. You take away the services that are now free and force them to pay for them. The end result is what the IMF loved. This is going to make a wonderful workforce, and business will invest. Okay? That's it.
Absolutely.
Now, the opposition. What do you do about the Democrats? See, historically, the Republicans have been a real political party. That is, they have represented the interests of the rich. And they did so unashamedly for many years, until the mid-1960s, They were joined by a group of fanatics. The soldiers of God, I call them. I don't know what you want to call them. But they were joined by people who were quite fanatic. And that the people whose interests were not simply in paying less taxes and having fewer problems with their servants, which is what the Republican Party was traditionally involved in. These people now were anti-abortion fanatics. They wanted desperately to have prayer in school. Well, I've never understood what exactly they wanted kids to pray for. To pass the exam, you know, kick the crap out of the other team in the football game. I don't know what they... Anyway. And they wanted everybody to have guns. Lots and lots of guns. I remember, you know, wonderful cartoon with Jules Pfeiffer with this stern-looking old fellow saying, abortions are bad. Abortions kill the unborn. Next caption, guns are good. Guns kill the postborn. The unborn are innocent and deserve our love. The postborn get what's coming to them. That pretty well summarizes it. All right? Now, where are the Democrats? Who do they represent? Will they represent the poor and the rich? They represent workers and the bosses. They represent the landlords and the tenants, the polluters and the environmentalists, the segregationists and the integrationists. You call this a political party? I call it a money laundering machine. The question is, how do you deal with the Democrats? You deal with the Democrats by accepting them because you can't change them. They cannot achieve a consensus. The Democrats are going, in foreign policy, they cannot adopt an anti-imperialist line. Can't do it. They don't have a consensus. On domestic politics, they can achieve a consensus around Social Security, around Medicare, around increasing services. And that's the area in which the Democrats are going to campaign. All right? And that is it. You can try and push more liberal Democrats into the party and try to oppose more conservative Democrats, but there's no way that you can take a John Dingell, who has been a congressman for more years than most of us have been alive. He represents General Motors and the United Auto Workers. And there are lots like him. All right. Now, why are they Democrats? Because the party gives them lots of money for their reelection campaign. That's why you... There's no principled reason to become a Democrat. All right. They are the only party available. Ralph Nader, as somebody said here, was polling almost 5% of the vote a week before the election. When the election came, 2% of the vote was what he got. That a lot of people chickened out at the polling place, and rightly so. The Democrats are going to be outspent 20-1 in the 2004 election, or at least 10-1. How do the Democrats respond? Because most money now goes into part of those 3,600 daily messages that you get machine gunned with. And the message is, vote for me, I'm better than that stinker over here. All right? Or, if you vote for that stinker, you won't breathe won't be able to breathe the air. There'll be war. Whatever, okay? You get no issues. As we discovered during the debates, Al Gore was simply not able to raise one single issue to force George Bush to say anything. I mean, he could have said, and that would have been a real stopper, can you tell me, Governor Bush, exactly what it is you have against peace and prosperity? Because Bush wasn't programmed to answer that. Where's that? Give me a drink.